Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I am interviewing Dr. Barry Singer. This is his second time on our podcast, and I'm so excited to have him share his expertise with us. He is the director and founder of the MS Center for Innovations in Care at Missouri Baptist Medical Center. He has been an investigator in greater than 35 multiple sclerosis trials and serves on the board of directors of the Multiple Sclerosis Association of America. His award-winning MS patient education website, mslivingwell.org, started in 2007 and has been a valuable resource in over 200 countries. He also shares his expertise on his podcast, MS Living Well, and on social media. On today's episode, we talk about early symptoms of multiple sclerosis, the kind of early that happens before you're even diagnosed. And we also talk about MS diagnosis and care. So make sure you have a pen and paper. The big question is, how does someone with MS actually improve their mobility, strength, energy, independence? The list goes on. My name is Dr. Gretchen Hawley, physical therapist and multiple sclerosis specialist. Welcome to the Missing Link podcast. Tune in as I share the top strategies and exercises to help you gain control over your life with MS using research-driven insights and advice from top industry experts. Whether you're newly diagnosed or have had MS for over 30 years, whether you have relapsing MS or progressive MS, this podcast is for you. You're sure to feel empowered and inspired after each episode. Ready? Let's dive in. Barry, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Oh, thanks, Gretchen, for the invitation.
Yes, I'm excited to have you back on the podcast. I think it's always so unique and interesting to hear perspectives from MS neurologists, because I feel like there's just a different approach to things, whether it be diagnosis or symptom management treatment. So I'm excited to dive into our questions. My first question for you today is about very first symptoms that someone might experience that could potentially lead to an MS diagnosis, like to be on the lookout for. Are there anything like that out there?
Yeah. I mean, so most people get diagnosed usually having one of three symptoms is usually the first attack when someone finally puts it together. So one would be visual loss out of one eye. So like your vision starts to get blurred and then maybe gets worse over 2-3 days, maybe very dark or you can't see out of it or cloudy. And then it starts to improve over a course of a couple of weeks, a couple of months. And we call that optic neuritis. Typically, yeah, pain with eye movement with that. And then, so that would be one attack, which is inflammation of the nerve from the eyeball to the brain. Another attack would be myelitis or transverse myelitis, which is like numbness in your feet, kind of sends up your torso, maybe comes up to, you know, your chest up here, and then maybe in your hands. And you might get balance problems, weakness in your legs. So that is what we call transverse myelitis, which is inflammation in the spinal cord, usually the cervical spinal cord, but it could be the thoracic. So a lot of people figure out this could be MS with an attack there. And then the third area is the brainstem. So if you get an attack in the brainstem, people can have vertigo, double vision, one side of their face goes numb. So frequently people figure out, hey, this is not right, and off to the neurologist and the scan gets done. So most people kind of present with their first attack. We call this clinically isolated syndrome with that attack.
So many patients that I work with will state that their first symptom was in year X, but they were diagnosed in year Y. And it's that gap is narrowing more recently, because when I first was an MS specialist about 9 or so years ago, almost every person said that their first symptom was at least 10 years prior, if not 20 or 30 years prior to when they were actually diagnosed. Now I'd say what I'm at least seeing is more so of a few years Do you see that as well?
No, I see a lot of people were dismissed for a long time. Actually, some people, that it was actually as a teenager, they had their first attack. It was kind of written off and no MRI was performed. So I do see it missed a lot. Some of the first symptoms, one would be before the first neurologic attack, frankly, people have symptoms before that. And we call it the MS prodrome. And so there's some great research, Helen Tremlett, that actually was one of my guests on the podcast. And we talked a lot about it on the MS Living Well podcast. But you can look back before someone gets MS. And it turns out that a lot of people are going, there's a higher rate of going to the hospital, getting admitted, hospital, increased risk of going to a doctor, more prescription meds going out. And these are for all kinds of things. Like one would be for GI problems. So you wouldn't think of GI problems being a big MS thing, but it is actually. And a lot of people are going to dermatology visits a lot more. You're seeing an increased rate of people going to psychiatrists, either seeing a psychiatrist or getting psychiatric medications. So there can be a lot of symptoms going on before. A lot of my patients will describe fatigue for years before they get diagnosed. And so overwhelming fatigue, they've been to their doctor, they've had 10 billion thyroid tests, they've had all kinds of workup, they're not anemic, their B12 levels are normal, and they just have overwhelming fatigue and no one gets it. And then boom, you know, 3 years later, they have their first attack and it turned out it was MS. So there is a lot of this, the symptoms beforehand. Now, there are a few really important symptoms that I think get overlooked by primary care docs. One is electric shock sensations down your spine when you bend your neck. We call that Lhermitte sign after a guy named Lhermitte. So that can be a sign of inflammation in your cervical spinal cord, and it can definitely be missed. Some people will have it for a couple months and it'll go away, and some people it's there all the time. So it's electric zap down your spine. And then you need an MRI or cervical spinal cord. Another symptom is called Uthoff's phenomenon, which means when you're overheated, symptoms can come out. Like you playing basketball and then your vision and your eye gets blurred because you're overheated, or you're exercising, you know, you're on the treadmill and then your feet start to get tingling and numb, and then you cool down, it goes away. So those neurologic symptoms that come and go can be part of it.
That's really interesting. I think most people listening to my podcast are already diagnosed with MS, but would you say that for someone who's does not have a diagnosis, that those two things in particular, the electrical zaps and then the heat intolerance, should be on their radar and they should promote that, like make sure they advocate for that to their doctors?
Yes, definitely. Especially, you know, if people are Googling and see the early symptoms of MS, they should be on the lookout. And frankly, it's very important. If you have MS, there is a higher risk of someone in your family potentially getting it. Not a high risk, but there is a risk. Being awareness of what are the symptoms of early MS make a big difference. Could mean being on treatment 5 years earlier than not.
Yeah, I was just going to say that that would lead to earlier treatment, which would hopefully then, you know, slow down that progression overall too.
Yeah. I mean, we have so many highly effective medications now. Really, it's about trying to get it diagnosed as soon as possible. I mean, some of our antibody therapies, some of the drugs were like prevented 90% of the lesions on the brain. So we have new ones now that are 97% better than the old drugs that prevented 80% of the lesions. So we have very effective medications, but it's about getting in early and getting people consistently on treatment.
Right. And so one question that I get a lot is, how am I diagnosed with this specific MS? So relapsing, primary, secondary, aggressive. How is that diagnosed? Is that specifically based on symptom presentation, or is it more than that?
Yeah, it's really based on your symptoms. So like if you had an attack, a relapse, let's say visual loss on one eye, and then you get better over 2 weeks, that's a relapse. 85% of people start out with relapsing remitting disease. So you have an attack, you get better, having another attack, get better. Maybe not fully back to normal, but you know, a good chunk of the way, 90% better. So those are relapses. And so most people start out with this relapsing remitting pattern. So you have an attack, then you're fine, then you go on. It could be a year, it could be 2 years, and then boom, you have another attack. So that's relapsing remitting. Now, over time, that group of patients can start to slowly get worse. Back in the day when there was no treatments, 90% of people would get progressive by the time you get out to 40 years. These days, we're seeing a lot less. One large data set showed 60% of people getting progressively worse. I think even as we get into more and more highly effective drugs, we're probably going to hopefully see that go less than 50%. And the key is really getting on treatment, consistently being on treatment early on. I mean, that's what I've seen over my career of doing this for decades, is seeing people that go on treatment early and really consistently take it, prevent that progressive phase. About 10 to 15% of people have slowly progressive disease from the beginning, and we call that primary progressive MS. So these are people that never really had a flare up, just, you know, they maybe have some trouble walking, they walk 3 miles and their leg starts clicking on the ground because of foot drop. And then, you know, gradually they can walk a little less and less over time, over a period of years. So that's primary progressive MS.
Is there anything that someone with MS, whether if they're diagnosed currently or if they're not yet diagnosed, is there anything they could do to speed up that diagnosis process, which is so hard because, you know, take a symptom like sensory changes, that could be a pinched nerve, it could be more muscular. There's so many reasons. Is there anything that we could do to speed that up ourselves, or do we really just have to go through all the tests?
Well, you definitely have to, you know, we usually diagnose MS with the MRI if there is concern about MS. MS affects the brain, the spinal cord, which is the cervical and thoracic spinal cord, not the low back, which is the lumbar spine. So the spinal cord actually ends in the midsection, which is thoracic spine. So there's nothing down the lumbar area. That's why you can do a spinal tap and stick a needle in there. You're not going to hit the spinal cord. And then also the nerves to the eye. So we frequently do MRIs to kind of find it. Now, you know, a neurologist, if you're sitting down with a neurologist, they're going to be able to start to figure out, is this numbness more like a pinched nerve, which tends to be like a band of numbness that goes down your leg, maybe down the side of your leg or the back of the leg, all the way stripped down. MS is more like stockings. So it's like maybe numbness around your feet. And then like if it's like pulling a sock up your leg, or even the stocking all the way up to the thighs. So it tends to go all the way around the leg or all the way around the arms. And if it's on both sides of your body, it tends to be a spinal cord problem. If it's on one side of your body, it could be spinal cord or brain. But one side of the brain controls the opposite side of the body. So it is important what gets scanned, because I've seen people where, oh, you got a pinched nerve in your back. Well, my pelvis is numb and my lower abdomen's numb. Well, that's not going to be just a pinched nerve. That's a pinched spinal cord. There's a little more to that. So I think it's really, if you got some weird symptoms going on, getting to, even starting with a general neurologist to sit down and kind of work through those symptoms. And if it's looking like MS, then MRI is the way to go.
So I saw research not too long ago, maybe a year or so ago, that was saying that African-Americans diagnosed with MS have a tendency to have a more aggressive form. Do we know why that is? Are there clinical trials around that or any assumptions as to what's going on with that?
Yeah, I mean, that's well known, well established. In fact, there's also some data in the Hispanic community as well, a higher risk for disability, but we definitely see it in the African-American or Black population in the U.S. There definitely seems to be a couple different things going on. Clearly, one is access to care is a huge issue. And we know that there's healthcare inequities in our U.S. system of healthcare. People with lower socioeconomic status, people have trouble accessing the system, maybe, unfortunately, unconscious biases of providers and maybe just insurance issues. And so we do see a lot of people who are not accessing the system soon enough. There may be some genetic factors. There are some genetic differences too, in terms of one gene called an HLA gene, which is a genetic immune marker, may play a role there, because we do see some genetic differences in our Black patients compared to Caucasian patients. So there may be some genetic factors, but definitely this is a big issue. And we want to be sometimes more aggressive in our treatment for our Black patients to get on top of the disease early to stop it. Now, it's a spectrum. I have a large Black population in my practice, and a lot of people do exceedingly well and have very mild disease or Black. So, I mean, I think it's not all, you know, straightforward, but it is important that we recognize these differences and treat appropriately.
Absolutely. And that kind of leads me to a question on getting diagnosed earlier, as we've been talking about, the earlier your diagnosis, the sooner you can start treatment. So one of the newest medications is Briumvi, and there's a huge conversation going on in a lot of MS communities right now around switching to Briumvi. It seems that a lot of neurologists are recommending that. And of course, everyone is different, so there's no one recommendation. But is there a reason for that? Is the research so compelling that that should be a conversation that they have with their neurologist, or is it just because it's the newest on the market?
Well, we have, frankly, we got three B-cell monoclonal antibody treatments that are potential options as first-line treatment for multiple sclerosis. The B-cell treatments include ocrelizumab or Ocrevus, and then we have Kesimpta, which is injected once a month underneath the skin, and that's also known as ofatumumab. And then we have Briumvi, which is ublituximab, our latest antibody treatment. And all these drugs are highly effective. They weren't compared to each other, so we don't have any head-to-head data. We do know that Ocrevus was compared to Rebif, and Briumvi and Kesimpta were compared to teriflunomide, so one of the oral medications. So, and they were all extremely effective. If you look at like drugs like teriflunomide and Rebif, they prevent about 80% of the spots on MRI. These drugs are somewhere between 95 to 98% better on in terms of active lesions. And most of these drugs cut relapses by around 50% plus, up to 60% compared to the old drugs. So I think they all have very effective, they're, some nuances, differences between each drug. And Briumvi is infused a little faster once you get on, and it's a 1 hour infusion with optional, you don't have to observe someone for an hour afterwards once you get on it. With Ocrevus, it's a 2 hour to 3.5 hours. If you're on it for a while, you can get down to 2 hour infusions, but then you need to be observed for an hour afterwards. So, some people, it's a little faster infusion for Briumvi, which is, I see a lot of rural patients that travel a long way already to come to see me. They get their infusion the same day. And so, shortening that up is an advantage there. For some people, the infusion in terms of, power, though, we don't really have significant differences there. There was some breast cancer cases in the Ocrevus clinical trial, as we follow patients over time, that doesn't seem to be, a significant issue showed up, but there were differences in the trial, and it's in the prescribing information, potential risk, which wasn't as much, that wasn't a big signal that showed up in Briumvi. So the cancer signal wasn't a huge concern there. So, some subtle differences here and there, but great options. And many of our patients opt for, first line to go straight onto these infusions.
Yeah, it's nice that there's so many options. Again, I haven't been an MS specialist for that long. It's just been almost 10 years, nine, somewhere around there. Yeah. But even that long ago, there were only 10, maybe 12 options at that time. And now there's over 20.
Yes. Yes.
And more on the way. And not only that, but completely different types of disease modifying therapies with the BTK inhibitors and anti-EV.
I've been doing a lot of research on those as well. I think that, what we try to do is try to fit the right drug for the right patient. Usually I'll bring up a couple options, two or three options that may be good for that individual patient. Some people have pretty mild disease. I look at their MRI. I mean, I saw someone this week, they had optic neuritis, about 3 lesions on the brain. They didn't have very much disease. So, an oral medication may be great. We got a variety of these. We got a few that are in the S1P class, which are oral medications. There's 4 of them. Then we have fumarates and a couple options there, one called Vumerity twice a day. Tecfidera is now generic. So, and Bifiratan in the same category. Then we have Mavenclad, which is a series of pills, just 5 days of pills. And a month later, you take 5 days of pills, you're done with for the first year. And the second year, you do the same thing, and years 3 and 4, no treatment. And then Aubagio is now generic, teriflunomide. And so we can get that inexpensively for people that don't have great coverage. So, a lot of options, but each one of these has some risks. Make some cause increase in blood pressure, some cause swelling in the back of the eye if you're a diabetic. So we look at medical problems. Do you have another autoimmune disease? Do you have a history of cancer? How much do we want to suppress your immune system to control the disease? Are you someone with 10 lesions in your spinal cord or one in your spinal cord, or, you know, you got 15 lesions in your brain, 30 lesions in your brain, or you have two in your brain? You know, how old you are, you know, as you age, you don't want to suppress your immune system quite as much if you're in your 60s or 70s compared if you're 25. So, you know, it's a, there's a lot to it to try to get people to the best option for them.
Yeah. Is there ever someone, if they meet all the criteria, where you wouldn't recommend a disease modifying therapy for? Or do you feel like regardless of how they're answering those questions, everyone should be on at least some form?
Yeah, I mean, everyone should probably be on treatment. Now, if you, at some age, you know, you may get away without being on treatment, but it's hard to know. I mean, I've seen as late as age 80, someone have an active lesion in the brain end up in the hospital. So it's always hard to know when the disease is done with someone. You know, but, you know, sometimes I'll have a patient who hadn't seen a neurologist forever and they're over, you know, 75 or older and they're fine and they're stable. Like, I wouldn't necessarily start disease modifying therapy at that age. But, you know, if you're in your 40s, 50s, 30s, 20s, you know, you really want to be on disease modifying therapy. I think without it, you know, I see a lot of people do fine for a while, but the tragic thing is I see people come in like 55, 65, and then they start having cognitive problems, or they go into progressive MS, what we call secondary progressive MS. You're out of the relapsing phase and now you're progressively getting weaker. And they, you know, it's terrible because if you lose your memory and your word finding abilities and you can't hold your job and, you know, or you can't keep up physically, then it affects your quality of life. So I see a lot of people get away with it for a while and then it starts to catch up. One of the things we know MS does is it can cause some shrinkage to the brain. I mean, all our brains are shrinking as we age, but it can happen a little faster rate with MS. And so some of these medications can help prevent that from happening, which is important for your cognition. So you have great brain health as you age. I mean, that's the whole game. It's about trying to age well. It's not just about, you know, how to get through the next year. It's really, I'm always thinking about long-term with my patients.
Is there a way to tell which lesions are causing which symptoms? And therefore, if those lesions get smaller or are more inactive, it would make sense that that specific symptom goes away? Or is it more generalized than that?
Well, it depends where the lesions are. It's a lot like real estate, location, location, location. So like the first three attacks I mentioned before, if it's in the optic nerve, boom, you're going to have visual impairment. If it's in the brainstem, double vision, vertigo, facial numbness. If it's in your spinal cord, you could get numbness in both legs, bowel, bladder, sexual dysfunction. So it's really about where it hits. Now, a lot of lesions happen without any symptoms. So many lesions deep in the brain are probably not going to cause any direct symptoms until you accumulate a bunch of them, and then it's going to start causing some memory problems. You can't process information quite as well. You have trouble finding words. And so your brain has to kind of reroute around these obstacles that are set up by these lesions or spots in the brain. And so it makes your brain an overdrive trying to reroute it. We can actually see this on a type of MRI called functional MRI. So it depends on where the lesions hit. Some will cause direct symptoms and we treat it with steroids and they get better if you have an acute relapse, but others can accumulate underneath the radar. Unless you do an MRI, you may not know about it.
That's so interesting. I feel like that would help me. I'm such a visual person, so I'd like to know where it's coming from. So that would be interesting information to know.
I think it helps too, because I think a lot of people, when you're young, like if you have a relapse and you feel, you know, you get your steroids and you're better or healed on its own and you're doing great, it's like, you know, out of sight, out of mind. But when you look at the scan and you see the actual lesions in your spinal cord and your brain, then I think it makes it very real. So I always go over my scans with my patients. And I think it's very important because if you got to take a medication regularly or you have to accept risk, it's kind of good to know what you're doing this for and why you're trying to preserve your, you know, your brain and your spinal cord for the decades to come. And so I think seeing it definitely helps. I'm a visual person as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's say you're working with someone who was having some of those prodrome symptoms and now they are newly diagnosed with MS. Is there any like key takeaways that you would want that person to know? Like, these are the top three things you should do as someone who's early diagnosed with MS.
Well, yeah, I think it's a combination of things. Well, once you're diagnosed, I think one clear important part is figuring out what you're going to do to prevent new lesions. And so the way to prevent new relapses, disability, and lesions is to go on treatment. So we have to kind of figure out the treatment piece. A lot of people, because they just got diagnosed, are having a relapse. And so they may need a course of steroids. Hopefully we can just do this outpatient, usually IV, but sometimes oral, get them on treatment. And so that's the most important thing, is kind of treat that relapse, get them on treatment. Now, some people have been dealing with this for a long time and have a lot of different problems going on and was kind of missed or underdiagnosed. And so they may have balance issues that need a physical therapist to help them out, or they may have nerve pain or fatigue issues. And we may work on strategies, many times without medications, to address these. But sometimes if symptoms are bad enough, then we'll prescribe a medication to kind of control the major symptoms that are really impairing their quality of life. And then we talk about, you know, exercise and, you know, what's going to be your exercise plan. Everyone with MS can exercise, almost everybody. I mean, I guess if you're quadriplegic, that would be hard, but almost everybody can do something. So we work on an exercise plan. You know, if you have no disability, you can get out there and run. I got people that were walking. I'm like, well, there's no reason why you can't run, or swim, or take a class, a Zumba class. You know, you got to find out what works really well for you. And then we talk about diet. You know, there's no proven diet like this is it for MS. There's definitely some data on the Mediterranean diet. And Lana Katz-Sands up at Mount Sinai has done some great work showing it's associated with less disability, Mediterranean diet, and particularly olive oil. There's some data on autoimmune diseases with intermittent fasting and the modified paleo diet. Terry Wells has been doing some research on that and talking about that for a long time. So hard to really prove it in clinical trials because people know what they're putting in their mouth. It's hard to blind that unless you're going to stick everything in a blender and you know, mix it with some kind of juice. It's hard to blind it to prove it, but I think it's really important. And if you're doing well, you know, we want to get your weight in a healthy range. Another huge component is smoking. So if you're smoking cigarettes, you really want to work on getting rid of that. There's been study after study that shows smokers end up with much more physical disability and cognitive problems, memory problems. So we really, if you're a smoker, that's got to be high priority and trying to stop getting the cigarettes in you.
Those are some really great takeaways that I feel like even if you're not early diagnosed, if you were diagnosed 30 years ago, those are still things that you should come back to and make sure you're on target with each of those.
Yeah, it's not all about the drugs. It's about, right, you know, just healthy, you know, healthy living is really important.
Thank you so much for sharing all this information with us. Again, it's so helpful to get insights from an MS neurologist. So I appreciate your time and your expertise.
All right. Thanks, Gretchen, for having me back on the show. And it's amazing what you're doing here and all the people you're helping out around the world.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for listening to today's show. I am so grateful to have you as a listener. If you'd like extra resources, such as a video of one of my seated exercise classes, my favorite core exercises, and the opportunity to ask me your questions, head to missinglink.com/insider. That link will be shared in the show notes along with links to my social media handles. If you loved this episode and think a friend or family member with MS would benefit from listening, please go ahead and text or email this podcast to them right now. Sharing this podcast will help me educate and empower as many MS warriors as possible. Thanks again for joining, and be sure to tune in next week for another episode of the Missing Link Podcast.